Interview with Judge Richard Posner, January 25th, 2011, in Chicago, Illinois, by Kenneth Durr.
Great. Well, let's go back to the early years a little bit. Want to talk a little bit about the state of corporate law when you were at Harvard. And was that a specialty? Did you think that you would go into areas of corporate law, antitrust, when you were at Harvard?
No. Well, I had a corporation law course from Derek Bach, you know, later became dean and president. It was a good course, he was a good teacher. I don't remember anything about the course. And I took Louis Loss's securities regulation course, which I also don't remember.
He later became sort of legendary in the field of securities laws, writing the book on it.
Oh, I think he was already. So this would have been about 1960. I think he had written his book, a book. And I took an antitrust course from Phil Reed. I didn't particularly like it at the time. Obviously, I later became interested in antitrust. But I wouldn't say the corporate area particularly excited me in law school.
What did excite you in law school?
I actually liked the common law courses, the first year courses in law school.
How did you land the job clerking for Justice Brennan?
He had delegated to Professor Freund, Paul Freund, the appointment of his law clerk. So Freund appointed me and another fellow. That was it.
Was this something that you get to register an interest in doing, or
no.
Do you just hear that you're it?
Yeah, no, I never applied for anything. No, you just picked. That was a very common way of appointing law clerks in those days.
Tell me a little bit about working for Justice Brennan. What kind of a guy was he?
Well, he's very nice person. Very good boss. He wasn't very interested in the details of legal analysis. So we wrote the opinions, and he would go over them. But I don't recall substantial editing. I was told that in later years, if he was dissatisfied with a law clerk's draft, he would write it himself. He had been a state Supreme Court justice before he came to the Supreme Court, so he knew how to write opinions. But if he liked the law clerks, he left it pretty much to them.
Who were your colleagues clerking?
Well, it's just one. You mean for Brennan or
yeah,
in general?
Yeah.
My co-law clerk was a fellow named Bob O'Neill, who later became president of Wisconsin University and Virginia University, and now has some position in the law school in Virginia.
That was a pretty pivotal time. Mid-60s, the Warren Court.
Well, not mid-60s. Yeah, this was the 1962 term. It was really the beginning of the full flowering of the Warren Court, because it was the year in which Goldberg replaced Frankfurter. So that was a decisive shift.
Why?
Well, now there was a very solid majority for, you know, Warren Court, typical liberal position is Warren, Black, Douglas,
right,
Goldberg, and Brennan. So they had five right there. And the others were Harlan, Stewart, Clark. So they were more conservative, only three of them. The ninth? Well, I know White came along pretty quickly, but I've forgotten who. Might have been Reed. But they had the solid, but when Goldberg replaced Frankfurter, they had the solid five liberals.
What were some notable cases that you were able to assist on in that period?
Well, one of them was Fay versus Noya, which was a big habeas corpus case, later overruled. Now, there was Sanders versus United States, which was a a case under 2255, you know, the habeas corpus substitute for federal prisoners. That was an important case in its time. It actually came out, I think, as a per curiam. Is that the one? No, that was under Brennan's. There was another important habeas corpus case that I wrote, Townsend versus Sane, which I think came out as a per curiam. It actually had been Warren had assigned it to himself, but I don't know, he couldn't do it or something. He asked Brennan to help him. And then Brennan asked me, so.
So you were able to actually...
And there was another important case, NAACP versus Button, about the use of litigation as a form of First Amendment expression. That was one I did for Brennan. But the one that was most significant for my career was United States versus Philadelphia National Bank. That was a big antitrust case. And that quickened my interest in antitrust. I don't remember the other cases I worked on anymore.
That was about the time the Silver case went through, having to do with the New York Stock Exchange. That was also an antitrust.
I don't remember that.
Okay. You talked about U.S. versus Philadelphia National Bank quickening your interest. What made that different from some of the other antitrust cases?
Well, there weren't a lot of antitrust cases. The previous year, Supreme Court had decided an antitrust case, Brown Shoe. These were both cases under Section 7 of the Clayton Act. So Section 7 had been amended in 1950 to strengthen its application to mergers. So the Brown Shoe opinion had been very murky and meandering. The law clerk who worked on it for Warren, I don't think he had any clue as to what was going on. So Philadelphia Bank was another Section 7 case. but in law school, on the law review, I had been assigned to site check a portion of a very good article by Derek Bach called Section 7 and the Merging of Law and Economics, in which he had argued for a simplified approach, Section 7 case. And I remembered that when I started working on Philadelphia Bank. And so I incorporated the idea of a simple prima facie case. I got that from Bach's article. So, just working on it, I thought this was interesting. I hadn't liked Phil Arida's course on antitrust. I think Arida, it may have been his first time he taught it. He later became a very, very successful teacher, but his antitrust course was not.
So
working on the case, and that as I say, quickened my interest in antitrust.
And it sounds like we're starting to see some of the emerging concerns that came out in the law and economics as you developed it.
Well, clearly there were economic issues. Yeah, I could see that. I didn't know any economics.
The other thing about your early experience that stands out is your time in the Solicitor General's office.
Yeah, although I spent 2 years in the Federal Trade Commission mm-hmm. between the Supreme Court and the SG's office. That was when I really got interested in antitrust, because that was a very big part of the FTC's jurisdiction.
Did you argue any cases in that capacity?
In the FTC?
No, going into the Solicitor General's.
Yeah, I argued two major antitrust cases. One was Vons Grocery, which was a merger case.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was the Schwinn case, which dealt with restricted distribution.
What was it like working for Thurgood Marshall?
Oh, well, we liked it. The people in the office liked it because he just backed the staff. It didn't matter what. So, and because he was a national figure, the Attorney General was hesitant to cross him. So we liked that. But he had no interest in the job. So he was just marking time.
He didn't have to mark.
It was just one of the jobs he had to do to become on this, to be appointed to the Supreme Court, but I said no interest in it.
Right.
So the office was run by the... there were three... they would now be called deputy solicitor generals. They were then... the first, second, and third assistant solicitor general, and the rest of us were just assistants to the solicitor general. And they were very good, and they ran the office, so okay. Everything was fine.
Did any securities cases come through during your period with the solicitor general?
Probably, but I don't remember. Okay.
Now, after your time there, you were tasked with, I think it was general counsel, for a study on the FTC. Obviously,
no,
given
no,
your previous
no, it was
experience.
A study, no. It was a task force on telecommunications policy.
Okay.
And you were the FTC.
You didn't look specifically at the FTC?
No, the FTC had nothing to do with telecommunications.
Okay. There was a certain antitrust component looking at AT&T, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. There was concern about the AT&T monopoly and its exclusion of its refusal to connect to potential competitors. It refused to allow attaching any equipment to the telephone network that hadn't been produced by Western Electric. So it certainly dealt with... We were dealing with problems of monopoly and competition, not with antitrust law as such.
Okay. You'd gotten a close look at the independent agency and administrative law with the FTC.
Yeah.
What was your take on it? What was your opinion? Was it working at that point? And I'm interested, obviously, in the analog to the Securities and Exchange Commission at the same period.
Well, the FTC was a backwater. It was an important part of the progressive movement. Federal Trade Commission Act, you know, passed same time as the Clayton Act. But over the years, it had dwindled. And it was a real backwater. But the commissioner I worked for, Phil Ellman, who had been in the Solicitor General's office and was, you know, and clerk for Frankfurt, he was a very, very smart lawyer. He was terrific. So he shook it up a lot. And... So I was the major author of the Federal Trade Commission's report on cigarette advertising and labeling. And the Federal Trade Commission did adopt a rule requiring disclosure of hazards of smoking and advertising and labeling. It was quickly preempted by Congress, which confined it to labels. But it was a bit, this is 64 or 65, this was a big thing for the Federal Trade Commission to do. That was the major consumer protection achievement of the 2 years I was there. But I wrote antitrust opinions for Allman. But he was very, very different from Brennan. He did a lot of rewriting. He was very engaged in the production of the opinions. He was very smart.
One of the questions here, and you might be in a position to talk about it, is how the judicial system, especially the Supreme Court, deals with administrative law. And you're looking at the FTC and the case law that would be shaped by that. Can you talk a little bit about what the general approach was during the 1960s and going into the 70s as far as the Supreme Court and administrative law cases generally?
No, I don't really remember. I imagine the Supreme Court was pretty tolerant of administrative action. I don't recall big fights. And of course, you know, there was the famous opinion, Yankee something, forgotten the name, where the Supreme Court slapped down the D.C. Circuit for imposing restrictions on administrative procedure that weren't in the Administrative Procedure Act. So I think the administrative agencies had, up until the deregulation movement in the late 70s, they had a lot of prestige from the New Deal and the Progressive Era. I think they were treated well by the courts.
The Chicago School, of course, in general, had a lot to do with coming up to that deregulation that you talk about. And at the same time, you're after this period, you're becoming involved with the shaping of the law and economics movement. Mm-hmm. Now, it's pretty clear that antitrust is something that's pretty central to that. Is corporate and securities law central as well? Why or why not?
Well, it wasn't a focus of my attention, but it was important because you know you had basically a broker's cartel in the securities industry, and there are also significant questions about the efficacy and need for the 1933 Act. So George Stigler, who was a famous economist in Chicago, he wrote a very critical empirical paper about the effect of the 1933 Act on new issues, trying to compare price movements and new issues after 33 with and before. It was a controversial article, but it was a strong attack on the SEC. And then Bill Baxter, a lawyer at Stanford, who was very knowledgeable about economics, he wrote a very critical article about the broker's cartel. So as part of the deregulation movement, there was criticism of the SEC. But I don't recall that there was kind of litigation that one had in antitrust. So I don't think the courts were that important in the change in the policies of the SEC.
This is the idea that the SEC was somehow a captive agency. It was
of the brokers, yeah. And then you also have in the 70s, late 70s, you had the rise of modern finance. And the notion that the securities markets are efficient markets, don't require much regulation, and the lots of conventional views about stock picking and market turn timing were erroneous. So that was an attack on the conventional view, not just the regulation, but conventional conception of the securities markets.
This is Henry
Manning. Also the, well, no, Manning's, his was a specific challenge to regulation, a prohibition of insider trading. Mm-hmm. That never went anywhere, but was typical of hostility to regulation, which is a big factor, obviously, in the deregulation movement.
Why don't you think it ever went anywhere?
The insider, the criticism of interest?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it ever made much sense. Obviously, people don't like to trade against insiders, right? They're
right.
A terrible disadvantage. So I don't know why he pushed so hard on that. But this, I don't think it convinced many people.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the topics, starting with insider trading, some of the key issues in securities law, as you experienced them, certainly in your experience on the Seventh Circuit. And one of the ones where you can see a lot of changes in insider trading from 1980 with Chiarella and moving through the 90s, the SEC's position and the way the courts are coming down, it seems to me, are changing fundamentally.
Really?
Is that?
Well, what is the fundamental?
Well, you're looking at different rationales, certainly, from the SEC's point of view, and the development of, you're going from what had been dominant in the 1960s with Texas Gulf Sulphur and moving to O'Hagan, where misappropriation becomes dominant. Is that true, or do you see any fundamental changes in the way insider trading law was interpreted by judges or argued by the SEC?
Well, I probably don't know enough about it to answer your question. Certainly,
you must have been involved in some insider trading cases on the Seventh Circuit.
I can't remember any.
Okay.
What's the change?
Well, I think it's interesting that the SEC was making different arguments at different times, looking for ways to justify prosecuting insider trading. But
why?
I
don't understand. So the objection to insider trading is that the insiders have an advantage against the rest of the world, and they can... That makes other people leery about investing if they have, in the stock market, they're competing against people who have that advantage. There's also the concern that insider trading allows losers to make a lot of money, right? They can trade as their stock is declining. They can sell their own stock short. Is there anything else to the objections to insider trading?
Oh,
is those two?
I'm not the expert. I
can't remember having an insider trading case.
How about takeovers?
Where?
How about corporate takeover statutes in the 1980s?
Oh, the poison pills and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the Mite case, I think it was Edgar versus Mite,
right,
in the Supreme Court.
Right.
Were you involved with that one?
No, that did come out of this circuit, though. No, I didn't. I had an unsuccessful effort to I had a case that was reversed by the Supreme Court. I don't know if they reversed my case or another case, but it was the sale of business doctrine that, which is hazy in my mind, there's a notion that if you sell an entire business, you don't have to make the ordinary disclosure. I don't know, whatever it is. Anyway, I was on one side of that. The Supreme Court took the other side. That's back in the 80s, so it's fuzzy in my mind. We did have, I think we had some poison pill cases, but the main ones were in Delaware, so I don't know a lot about them.
Was CTS, does that ring a bell?
Vaguely.
I think that was the Seventh Circuit as well.
No, I don't.
Okay. During your time in the Seventh Circuit, are there any securities cases that stand out as being significant or important to you?
Well, I have written a number of securities cases, and the other judge who done that particularly is Judge Easterbrook. I really ought to talk to him. So that's one of his academic fields, securities law, which wasn't mine. Wrote a case called Bastian, B-A-S-T-I-A-N, which was about the causal issues, separating out sort of accidental consequences of buying or selling from the consequences that are due to the actual misrepresentation. You know, loss causation versus whatever the term is. So that was one. And I wrote an opinion, I think it's called Scattered, which was about whether you can sell short more stock than the company owns. We said yes. So that was fun.
Why did you say yes?
There was nothing to prohibit it. It's just a form of speculation. Recently, I had I wrote the opinion in the remand of the Telabs case. So that had come from the circuit. I wasn't on the original panel, but when it came back from the Supreme Court, I wrote an opinion trying to make sense of the Supreme Court's new standard. And I've written other securities law opinions, but I don't have a clear recollection on that.
What was the issue at hand in the Telabs case?
See if I can reconstruct that. Well, it's vague in my mind. It had to do with how much the senior officers had to know in order to be, in order for the complaint to survive dismissal. We said it was enough, and that was, I think, the end of the case. But I don't remember the details at all.
Okay.
Although it's not that long ago.
Did this have to do with secondary participants in the ability to aiders and abettors, that kind of thing?
No, I think the aiders and abettors have been eliminated.
Okay.
Liability had been eliminated earlier. I may have written something on that.
When judges are looking
at... You could look up, you know, on Westlaw.
Sure.
My opinion, security, word security's in, but I don't have a good recollection.
Is it your experience that judges pay particularly close attention to what the Supreme Court's attitude might be toward their decisions when they're making them?
Some do. I don't. Depends. Some of the Court of Appeals judges follow the Supreme Court, you know, read all their decisions and try to figure out what's next on their agenda. But most judges don't bother with that. They just take what the Supreme Court has said without worrying about how they might change. I mean, obviously, this court is very pro-business, but
right.
Hasn't yet done a lot. And I wrote a dissent recently in the case the Supreme Court took and reversed, Jones versus Harris, involving mutual fund fees. That's within the SEC's domain. So I think I've probably written a number of opinions over the years, but I don't remember most of them.
Okay. Well, the law and economics movement, one of the fundamentals, at least as I understand it, is to look at outcomes. Is that a correct statement?
No.
To evaluate outcomes. In the case of securities law, what would those outcomes be, and how does one evaluate them?
Well, well, you want to create a competitive market in securities, and as in any other competitive market, you want to minimize transaction costs, and you want to prevent fraud. I mean, ideally, you'd like people to make the choice between buying equities and bonds or other forms of security just to be based on risk and expected return and transaction costs. So you want a system of regulation or non-regulation that minimizes transaction costs and promotes information and so on.
Are there examples of cases where you have taken such considerations into account?
Oh, I'm sure I'm sure that's a concern whenever I have a securities case, but I can't recite chapter and verse.
Well, in your experience, and you started earlier in your career, you were involved with an administrative agency, and you've had a chance to think about such things. In your experience, does the administrative agency, is it still viable? Is something like the SEC still a viable, efficient way to administer markets?
Well, I don't know much about the SEC. Of course, it took a terrific hit in the 2000s with the Madoff business, and the totally incompetent management by Christopher Cox, which contributed to the dive, the economic crisis. Now it has a much better chairman, and I assume, and it's got more funding, so I'm sure it's rebuilding and improving. What it will do, I don't know whether it'll be successful. It wants to regulate hedge funds. Not clear that that's worth doing. The greatest failure of the SEC in this past decade was its total oblivion to the transformation of the banking industry, so that the big broker dealers, they had really become banks. And all the SEC was worrying about was, consumer protection, doing it ineptly. But it had no sense of the macroeconomic significance of companies like Goldman and Morgan, Lehman Brothers. You still have this very divided regulation because... even though Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are now bank holding companies, and Merrill Lynch is owned by a bank and so on, nevertheless, the non-banking activities, which include a great deal of financing, banking by another name, of these companies are still regulated by the SEC.
Right.
The SEC has had to create a new division to try to be a little really like a banking regulatory agency. I don't know what success they've had. The SEC has always had a good reputation, partly because, unlike the FTC, it offered a good career path for lawyers. They could work for the SEC for a few years and then go into practice. Whereas the FTC, practice opportunities weren't very good. So working with... So, I think SEC has always been pretty high class agency in terms of personnel, although obviously fell down very badly with the Madoff. So it's a good agency, but
how important has the difference between state regulation and federal regulation been?
I don't know anything about state regulation. What, blue sky laws?
Every state has its own.
Of them, yeah.
Okay. And that's not something that the courts would end up...
Not the federal courts, no.
Okay. Right. Anything else that in your career that might be relevant to the development of securities law that we should talk about?
Well, I did I do think there are a lot of abuses. Jones versus Harris, the different fees for captive mutual funds and independent mutual funds, different fees charged by the investment advisor.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed pretty pretty abusive. I don't know if the SEC is active in dealing with that. I know there are complaints that compliance with SEC regulations is very cumbersome. But I haven't conducted a root and branch. Like the prospectuses for new issues, do they have any function really, or is it just boilerplate? And is anybody paying attention to them? I think Rule 10b-5 is useful and suits under it are fine. But I'm just not enough of an expert on the SEC to... One thing that's happened is that the... efficient markets theory has taken a hit in this economic crisis. It's obvious that, you know, there's a bubble. There have been two big stock bubbles and a housing bubble in recent years. So clearly a lot of the trading is not based on estimates of corporate earnings. They're based on what people think other people think.
Right.
So I don't know if the SEC can deal with bubbles. But it really underscores the need for regulation, since the bubble phenomenon is not apparently not self-correcting. The market doesn't avoid bubbles, so maybe that calls for government regulation.
All right, well, if there's nothing else, then
I can't think of anything.
Thank you very much for your time.